Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, Conversation for Exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Loralee. So many people have noticed some interesting acoustical properties in the King's Chamber and the Queen's Chamber of the Great Pyramid of Egypt. And I know that when we were there with John Anthony West, we were toning in all sorts of places. And we got to the King's Chamber, and a group of about 25 of us just started toning. Mind you, we're not expert singers, none of us, but we sounded like a chorus of angels. This was something special about the King's Chamber because we certainly didn't sound that good, nowhere near it, in some of the other places where we were toning. But John West wanted to set this up as a test. And in fact, my husband Paul, with his handy equipment, recording equipment that he brings everywhere, he caught this, and we've played it for you on this show, toning in other places, toning in the Great Pyramids, and you hear that angelic quality, something about the acoustics in there. Well, finally, at last, we have found an acoustics engineer who can address this mystery, and that is John Reed. He is an Englishman, so he joins us, and he has done some astounding acoustical experiments there in the Great Pyramid and other places, and he's here to share with us his report. John, welcome. So good to have you here.
Great to be here, Loralee. Thanks.
Oh, and I also want to mention, thank you for contributing that article from the acoustics engineer point of view that you did in our current newsletter on the obelisk of Hatshepsut that sits down where you can bang it with your fist lightly, and it rings like a bell.
Yes,
thank you also for that.
Fascinating concept, isn't it? And hopefully there'll be a book in that on that subject in the future also.
How did you get into the study of acoustics?
Well, oddly enough, this really it's a story that goes back to 1500 BC, because around that time, of course, the Tutankhamun died, and with his death comes the beginning of this story, because what, of course, happened was in the 1920s, as you know, the tomb was finally found intact. And in the newspapers and the radio of the day, the stories were coming out all the time about the latest artifacts to emerge from the tomb. And, of course, around about that time, my grandfather was an avid listener of the radio, and he became very, very interested in the whole subject. About the same time, my father, who was just a young boy of 8, was also inspired. And, of course, well, you can guess what happened. He then inspired me. So basically, I became inspired because of Tutankhamun's death, 1500 BC, you know. So it's a strange way that I came to be interested in Egyptology.
And what about acoustics? What led you to study acoustics? There's many ways of studying the world around us and of Egyptology, but you chose acoustics.
Well, I've always been interested in sound. You know, I think each of us have our own particular leanings, and in this particular instance, I mean, I took up music at quite a young age, and I always had a feeling for sound. So I guess it was a genetic thing, you know. I just basically very, very interested in sound, always have been, right from being a very young child.
So how did you set up the acoustic experiments in the Great Pyramid? What were your parameters and what was your mission there?
Well, the story really begins in 1996, because in 1996 I visited the Great Pyramid just like any other tourist, and I suppose like the numberless millions of people before me, I stood also at the foot of this man-made mountain of stone, and but it was my experience actually inside the pyramid which triggered my thoughts relating to possibilities for mounting my own research mission. You see, basically, as an acoustics engineer, my ears tell me a lot about a place. And the acoustics of the King's Chamber were, I don't know, probably the most unusual I'd ever heard. For example, the reverberation time for this King's Chamber is amazingly long for such a small chamber. It's about 4 seconds. And this is the sort of time that I would expect of a large cathedral or a church, perhaps.
So when you sound a tone, 4 seconds is the time it takes for that tone to fade away in the King's Chamber?
Well, yeah, basically that's it. I mean, I don't need to go into the technical aspect of
Please educate us as we go along.
Well, basically...
We're here to learn.
Oh, well, okay. Well, any event, if you, say, clap your hands, for example, any event such as that or any sound that you make naturally decays. If you stop making the sound, it then does take a certain period of time for that sound to decay. And in the case of the reverberation time, or RT as it's known in acoustical speak, 1/1,000,000th of the original intensity is the point at which an acoustics engineer would say that is the RT. So when it's decayed by 1/1,000,000th of its original intensity. So in this case, if you make a sound in the King's Chamber and then stop making that sound, the RT will be around 4 seconds, just over 4 seconds.
Is that because the sound waves are bouncing back and forth on the walls?
It is basically because the whole chamber is lined with granite, and it's also to do with the dimensions of the chamber as well, which is something that we could also discuss, because the ancient Egyptians constructed that chamber in a particular ratio, which is 2:1, and the 2:1 ratio just so happens to be the ratio, one of the ratios which creates the longest RTs. So that's one of the reasons why I believe that this particular chamber was engineered and is not just purely accident.
You believe that the ancient builders deliberately engineered the chamber for its acoustic properties, among others?
Yes, I do. What actually led me to believe that, apart from the dimensions, was that when I actually lay in the sarcophagus, that's the granite coffin within the chamber, I performed a simple glissando. This is a sort of smooth, unstepped enunciation of sound, and at one particular frequency, which I guess to be around 100 hertz, my whole body was washed in sonic waves, and I saw there was sort of shivers of emotion running up and down my spine, and it was then at that point that the thought just popped into my mind that the acoustics of the chamber were no accident, that I felt they were designed. And so there and then I decided to mount my own research mission to the pyramid.
So one of those tools is the ratio, the 2:1, which tends to lengthen the RT, the reverberation time. The other is the granite, which is also a factor in causing that obelisk to ring. Tell us about granite and its properties.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously the fact that the granite is not available in the locale was quite significant for me. The ancient Egyptians had to go 500 miles south of Giza to acquire the granite, and there's a quarry at a place called Aswan. And of course granite is a difficult stone to quarry in the first instance. Then they had to bring it all the way up the Nile to Giza in order to use it. So I figured that, quite reasonably I think, that they must have had some pretty good reason to bring granite that kind of distance, and there would have been a huge expense involved, not necessarily in monetary terms, but certainly in terms of the effort involved. It was a huge effort, and so they must have had a very, very good reason to use granite. Now, obviously, there are many possible reasons, and in my booklet that you talked about, I actually set out a lot of the arguments, you know, the different possibilities. For example, granite could have been used simply as a means of preventing intrusion into the burial chamber or into the main chamber. Lots of people, including myself, don't believe it's really a burial chamber, but nevertheless. But you'll see if you read my booklet that all of the many arguments that are possible for the reasons that they use granite, none of them really fit the bill. And my belief is that granite was chosen specifically for its acoustical properties. It is probably the most resonant stone on Earth.
What makes
Certainly
it so
one
resonant?
One of the most resonant stones on Earth.
What gives it its resonant qualities, John?
It's quartz content. I mean, quartz is an incredibly resonant crystal. And of course...
Oh, it's what we use in radio and all that.
Absolutely,
quartz crystals,
yes.
Yeah.
Quartz is a product which is used in many, many different electronics applications today. And it's used for its resonant properties. So the fact that granite contains such a large percentage of quartz is the reason that granite as a stone is so highly resonant. So I believe that the ancient Egyptians chose that stone because of its resonant properties.
What gives a quartz crystal and any crystal those qualities? Is it because its molecules are laid out and stacked up so nice and neatly in a matrix?
Exactly. That's the exact reason. And of course, the actual formation, the way that the crystal is formed, the direction of the faces, the lattice itself, all lend itself to resonance. Because, like as we were saying earlier, you know, the fact that in the King's Chamber you have parallel-facing walls, mm-hmm. and between those walls you can get standing waves set up. This is energy, in this case acoustic energy, which reflects between the parallel walls. Well, similar sorts of things happen at a very minute level within crystals themselves.
Oh, I see. Those
kind
facing
of energy
planes.
Transfers okay. between parallel faces, and this is how crystals are in fact incredibly resonant.
You know, you can imagine how hard it would be to manufacture a material like granite with all of these perfect little crystals embedded uniformly throughout. How does nature do it? You know, what is it about granite? Is it igneous rock? Or where does it come from?
It is an igneous rock, of course. It's rock which has been regurgitated. You know, that in the great depths of the crust of the earth, the rocks are molten, of course, and bonded together under amazing pressures and amazing heat, and eventually granite comes to the surface. When it cools, the crystals form within the rock. It's a very, very long, slow process. It takes millions of years for it to happen. But, of course, in the end, we end up with these outcrops on the surface.
Are the planes of the crystal in a hunk of granite all kind of facing the same way, or are they all random?
No, they're fairly random, actually. But, of course, you get an overall effect. You get this effect created by the fact that you've got so much quartz within a given volume of granite. So it's the individual pieces of quartz, which we can talk about later in terms of some of the research that I've actually done within the pyramid itself, specifically within the sarcophagus. The individual pieces of quartz have their own tale to tell, which we'll get to a little bit later, but certainly the overall volume of quartz, it's almost, in a sense, it's like having a huge chunk of quartz, like we were saying about the obelisks. You know, there is so much quartz in granite that it's almost like having a giant wand, you know, an actual crystal wand there. It's a similar sort of thing as that, because simply the material that is not quartz within granite is a very small percentage. We're only talking about a few percent of feldspar. Most of the material is actually quartz crystal.
So what kind of equipment did you take with you when you went back to the Great Pyramid to set up those experiments? And did you get permission? Did you just sort of sneak it in? How did you set this up?
Yeah, I certainly got permission. In fact, the antiquities inspector or the acting antiquities inspector, was with me, making certain that I didn't do anything that I shouldn't in there. In terms of the equipment, the sort of stuff that I guess any acoustical engineer uses, spectrum analyzers, oscillators, all manner of high-tech equipment, which is obviously necessary in order to discover or to examine the acoustics of any particular space. So in this particular instance, I had two suitcases full of this equipment, very heavy suitcases. And of course, one of the things, as luck would have it, one of the things that happened about a week before I was due to go out there, I actually injured my back quite severely, just purely by accident lifting something that I shouldn't have done in a strange way, injured my back. And so I had this huge problem. I had this mission booked. It cost me a lot of money, of course, and I was really concerned. I didn't know how I was going to get out there and actually lift these suitcases, how I was going to set up the experiments and so on. But luckily, a friend of mine said he would come with me at the last minute, and a male friend, and he's a very big, strong man. And so he actually ended up lifting the suitcases into the pyramid for me, because I certainly couldn't have done it myself.
But your back had some help as well.
Well, it did. This was one of the amazing things that happened for me, Laura Lee. It was quite astounding. I was well into the experiments. I suppose I was in by about an hour or so, and I was in great pain. I mean, I'd taken the maximum dosage of painkillers that you could take, and yet still I had this very severe pain in my lower back. I was in a sort of cold sweat, and I said a little prayer before I started. I mean, that's the kind of level of pain I was in. I really did not know how I was going to get through this session. But about an hour into the experiments, I was creating sound, pink noise, as they call it, pink noise in the Great Pyramid's King's Chamber. And I was bending over the sarcophagus at the time. I remember the moment. And I suddenly thought, hang on, I'm not in pain anymore. The pain had completely left me. And there was just no pain at all. So I sort of straightened up, felt my back, my lower back, and all the pain had gone. And that was, you know, quite an amazing experience for me, because in the past, I mean, I have a weak back, certainly, and in the past when I've had these sort of episodes of pain due to some injury or whatever, I know it takes weeks and weeks for this pain to subside. And yet here I was, only literally a few days after having injured my back and having gone in there in severe pain,
maybe
and yet the pain left me.
Maybe those ancients were practicing a little sound therapy as well.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, certainly something happened in there. I believe, having had a lot of thought about it, and of course I'm actually trying to investigate this phenomenon myself at the moment, but I believe that what happened at a cellular level, possibly even a molecular level, and it was a sort of a realignment of the molecules in my body, and that's the only way that I can explain it at the moment, but I'm hoping to come up with some hard science to back this up. But what actually happened, Laura Lee, was when I got back to the UK after, I know we're jumping ahead a little bit here, but relevant to this, when I got back to the UK, I was obviously very excited about the various discoveries that I'd made, but also about this amazing healing effect. And I rang a friend of mine up in London who is a lady called Judith Page, and she's actually an artist of some skill, and she always chooses ancient Egyptian as her ancient Egypt as her subject. And I spoke to Judith on this subject and told her about my amazing healing experience. And she recounted a story to me about a healing experience that she had had in there. She'd actually injured her knee at some point, quite a severe injury. And a bit like me, she'd already had a holiday booked to Egypt and couldn't cancel, so she went along anyway. And one of the things that she did on the holiday was, again, like me, she lay in the sarcophagus and she chanted for about 3 hours. And I said, hang on, you can't do that. You know, they won't let you do that. And she said, oh, when I do it, they get fed up and they just go away, you know. So anyway, she chanted for about 3 hours. And when she'd finally emerged from the sarcophagus, all the pain in her knee was gone and her knee was fully healed. So if Judith had told me that story before I'd had my amazing healing, I don't think I would have believed her, you know, but under the circumstances, of course, I believed her. So, yeah, I mean, there is some strange mechanism at work here, and I'm obviously intent on discovering that mechanism. I really do believe that the ancient Egyptians would have made very good use of such mechanisms.
Well, I think we should in the future. I think vibrational medicine in the future will come into its own, hopefully, and we'll have chambers where you can walk in and get your body molecularly dry cleaned or something. I don't know, realigned.
I think almost certainly that will happen, because I know that what happened to me was a real effect. It wasn't anything imagined. I mean, like I said, you know, I couldn't carry the equipment into the pyramid,
gotcha.
But I actually packed it up and helped to carry it out. So that was the extent of the healing. And, you know, those of your listeners who think, oh, well, maybe it was just the high, you know, the adrenaline, the endorphins or whatever that blocked the pain out. No, it wasn't that, because not only did I lift the equipment out of the pyramid, but also the pain did not come back. You know, even getting back into the aeroplane and so on, flying back home, no pain at all. So it was a real healing effect.
That's wonderful. Now, you had spectrum analysis analyzers, you had oscillators, you also had some cymatic resonance equipment. So I want to hear about the results of the test, what kind of test you, besides your own body, that's, you know, another vehicle for, instrument for testing, isn't it, as you found out. What did you bring in? How did you set it up? What were you looking for, and what did you find, John?
Well, before discussing the cymatics, if you don't mind, I think it would be probably better in context to talk about a couple of other experiments that I did. Maybe we can...
Oh, I wanted to end with the cymatics.
Oh, do you?
All
right.
Oh, yes. You indeed. Okay. Which you say was the most important experiment of all, but I wanted to hear about all of them in succession.
All of the experiments, yeah. Right. Okay. Well, I think perhaps the most important experiments were the cymatics, but there were other experiments that I performed in the chamber which were also very important. One of them was to discover the prime resonant frequency of the chamber itself and also of the sarcophagus. I was very interested to know because when I'd originally been there in 1996 and performed this simple vocal glissando, which, by the way, anyone can do. I mean, you can do it in your own bathroom at home.
What is a glissando? What are you talking about?
It's just basically a smooth, unstepped enunciation of a tone.
Can you demonstrate?
A quick demo. That sort of thing.
Okay.
But if you're going to do it in your own bathroom, you need to do it really quite slowly. And best to face one wall of the bathroom, and preferably not a wall that has a window in it. So most bathrooms are tiled, of course. And if you just face towards one wall and make this glissando, do it very slowly, and have your eyes closed, preferably as well. And when you do this, what you'll be listening for is the loudest sound that sort of comes out and hits you almost, you know. It's a... When you find it, you will know that it is the loudest sound, because it really will be very loud. And when you found that sound, what it is, it's the frequency at which the sound waves are standing between the two parallel surfaces in your bathroom, and they're called standing waves. Hmm. And this frequency, determined by the actual dimensions of your bathroom, is what determines the prime resonant frequency of that particular space. Now, in my case, of course, I was interested in the prime resonant frequency of the King's Chamber itself, and also of the sarcophagus. And what happened was, when I performed this experiment, not with a vocal glissando, I had done that, as I said, in 96, but this time, of course, I went with an oscillator and with spectrum analyzers and so on. And when I performed that experiment in the chamber itself, in the King's Chamber, I found that the resonant frequency was 121 hertz. Now, that's round about an A sharp in musical notation. Not that that means anything in particular, but just for those listeners who are interested in these things, it's about A sharp. But the amazing thing was that when I did the same experiment for the sarcophagus, I found that the sarcophagus prime resonant frequency is 117. Now, that's only 4 hertz away from the prime resonant frequency of the chamber as a whole.
So it very nearly matches.
It's almost exactly the same. Now, the amazing thing here is, Laura Lee, that if the sarcophagus was not damaged, you know, I don't know, some of you probably know.
Oh,
that
it is damaged. So if it wasn't,
damaged,
maybe its
right.
prime resonant frequency would be the 121.
Would be exactly the same. That's what I'm saying. That the south, what is it, the southeast corner, I think it is quite badly damaged.
Chipped away, yeah.
And no one knows why that is. Maybe in the past people have been striking the sarcophagus to make it ring, because it really does ring like a bell. Whatever the reason, it is badly damaged. And of course, if the material was had not been damaged, it is my belief that the sarcophagus would be ringing true at exactly 121, which is the prime resonant frequency of the chamber. But even at 117, that is very, very close. And, you know, if you were...
And tell us when we come back, John. We're talking with John Reed. His book is Egyptian Sonics. He'll tell us more about the acoustical experiments that he conducted in the Great Pyramid and King's Chamber in particular. I'm Laura Lee. Let's get back to our conversation with acoustics engineer John Reed about his experiments in the King's Chamber. So you found the prime frequency of the chamber and of that sarcophagus very, very close, might have been in earlier days identical. Then what?
Well, I went on then to perform some other experiments, of course, and one of the experiments was concerned with looking very closely at the resonant properties of the sarcophagus itself. Now, there are a number of tools that we can actually use to explore these particular resonant properties of the sarcophagus. One of them was simply to use an oscillator to excite the granite of the sarcophagus and to simply pick up the sound on a special microphone and look at the output on an analyzer. But whilst performing this particular experiment, something really quite amazing happened, and that was that I started to hear what sounded like a beating heart, literally boom, 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 this sort of sound coming from the sarcophagus itself. And
What caused it? What would cause it to start?
Well, basically it's caused by beat frequencies. If I can explain what that means, it's, in this case, we excited the sarcophagus, or I excited the sarcophagus at a particular frequency. And then when I moved the oscillator to a new frequency, the sarcophagus said, no, I want to continue resonating at the first frequency.
Oh, it had a preferred. Now, do most objects have that, or do they have to be especially designed? And one gets the impression that for the prime frequencies of both the chamber and the sarcophagus to be so close, that these were designed, not just accidental.
Well, exactly, and that is my hypothesis, or certainly part of my hypothesis. In fact, when you create any sound in the King's Chamber itself, most of that energy ends up in the sarcophagus, and of course this is a
really?
Discovery in itself. But in this particular instance, what I discovered was that the sarcophagus has a number of very important and powerful beat frequencies, and they sound very like a beating heart. And of course, when this happened, I got very, very excited, and so did the antiquities inspector. I think he thought I was going to damage his sarcophagus, but in fact, there was certainly no danger of that. But when I heard this beating heart sound, it certainly got me very excited. And when I eventually got back to England, I checked out my own heart sound using a stethoscope and an analyzer, and I found that the particular Mach space ratio that I'd discovered in the sarcophagus was not relevant to my heart. But I then went on to examine the heart sounds of babies.
Oh.
And I went to a hospital and to a maternity department, you know, and I took some heart sounds of babies. And I found that the center frequency of babies' hearts matched exactly the frequency and the Mach space ratio of the sarcophagus in the King's Chamber. Now, this could be coincidental. I mean, I went down this particular line of research because, you know, I am a scientist and I'm investigating, right? But I mean,
You're gathering the data.
It's an amazing coincidence. If it is a coincidence, it's an amazing coincidence.
Oh, how interesting.
Sorry, Laura Lee.
Oh, I was just going to say how interesting. Go ahead.
Well, it is, yeah. And what I was going to go on to say was that took me down a particular avenue of research, because when I knew that a baby's heart sound resembled the output of the sarcophagus, it got me thinking about some various ritualistic instruments which had been discovered in the pyramid in 1860. There was an engineer, I think Wayman Dixon, in 1860, discovered some instruments in the chamber, in the Queen's Chamber. And one of these instruments is called a Peshesh Kaf. And what a Peshesh Kaf is, it's a small flint object which you use, or was used in those days, for circumflexing around the umbilical cord of a new baby. That is to say, a tool used for severing the umbilical cord of a newborn baby. So because this instrument had been found in the pyramid in 1860, and it was sealed within one of the shafts of the Queen's Chamber, so it must have been there right from the day that the pyramid was completed. We know that there is a fetal symbolism associated with the pyramid. So when I made my discovery concerning these heartbeats, the baby heartbeats, if you like, from the sarcophagus, I got quite excited, because obviously that is a further proof or further evidence of fetal symbolism within the pyramid.
It's all about death and regeneration too, isn't it? Death and rebirth.
Well, of course, you know, I mean, the whole pyramid is connected with rebirth symbolism. It's your own Dr. René Friedman who believes that the pyramid was, in fact, a resurrection machine. And certainly when you go into the pyramids, particularly when you're in the Grand Gallery, you do get this feeling that you are in a sort of giant machine, or that you're in the bowels of a giant machine. But yes, it was very, very, very powerfully connected with rebirth symbolism. So this discovery of the heartbeats may prove to be very relevant in the future.
You mentioned that most of the energy when you start sounding in the Great Pyramid goes to the sarcophagus. Would that be in a similar way like a tuning fork, because the two are so closely connected in terms of their prime frequency? You sound one and one picks the other up. And if the sarcophagus has a frequency it likes and it tends to move and stay towards that, would that be one reason why all of us non-professionals sounded so angelic toning in the pyramid? Would it actually kind of, you know, line up our voices and reflecting them and get them all stacked up nice and neat so they sounded more pure?
Well, I think the main reason that you sounded so angelic, Laura Lee, is simply because of the long reverberation time.
Does it even things out, or what does that do?
Well, it does, yes. I mean, reverberation simply extends our voice sounds, and so we can if you sing in the bath, you know how you sound better singing in the bath, well, or in the bathroom. Certainly, it is even more so for chambers such as the King's Chamber with a four-second reverberation time. So, I mean, singing in your own bathroom as an RT of, I don't know,
anybody can sound good given the right surroundings, I guess.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. I mean, about 1.5 seconds to 2 seconds, perhaps, for a really large bathroom. But in this case, we're talking 4 seconds. So, yeah, I mean, it really does make you sound very good indeed because it extends all your sounds. And basically, that is why, you know, Gregorian chant, how in Gregorian chant, the vowel sounds are very long and extended. One of the reasons for that is that intelligibility is greatly reduced when you trying to speak, let's say, in a chamber with a very long reverberation time. So in churches in the past, in cathedrals and churches and other religious structures that were large, physically large, they naturally have quite long reverberation times. And so when someone was speaking in those structures, they would have to speak very slowly so that they could be understood. And similarly, you know, with Gregorian chant, if you notice, all the vowel sounds are very long and extended. It's a similar sort of thing. So I guess that the ancient Egyptian priests would have also sung very slowly in order for the sounds to be actually heard clearly. But yes, what you were saying there about the way that the sound is coupled is the acoustic term. Sound that you make in the chamber is coupled into the sarcophagus, so most of that energy ends up in the sarcophagus. And this was one of the things that I discovered. And I say I have a lot of very interesting information concerning that coupling.
Okay, and what else did you find?
Well, you wanted to talk about cymatics, and I guess this is really the sort of the major part of my discovery. So would you like to talk about cymatics now, Laura?
Oh, indeed I would.
I thought you would say that. Well, cymatics is basically the study of wave phenomena. The term cymatics was coined by the Swiss scientist Hans Jenny in the 1960s. He was investigating this particular phenomena of waves. And unfortunately, he's no longer with us, but he did some extremely good work in this particular field. What it is, it's basically the, put in very simple terms, it's a way of seeing sound. If you have a membrane, and the membrane can be made of an artificial material such as PVC, which is what I used, or you can use an animal skin, you can use any kind of membrane, rubber or whatever. If you then sprinkle on that membrane, the taut membrane, by the way, a bit like a drum. If you then sprinkle on that membrane some sand, I use quartz sand typically because it's more resonant. If you sprinkle quartz sand on that membrane and then you excite the membrane with sound from your own voice or from whatever chamber that you are investigating, you will see patterns emerging on the membrane. Now, if I can just explain what these patterns really mean.
Please.
If you could see the sound coming out of your own voice, Laura Lee, your own mouth, what would it look like? Well, to begin with, you need to know that it is spherical in shape. So as you are speaking,
really?
Or singing even, the sound that's emerging from your voice, from your mouth, is spherical. It's like a huge bubble.
Or like ripples in a pond, only in a three-dimensional way? Or?
Yes, in that way, yes. But if you can first of all visualize this bubble emerging from your mouth, and the bubble's obviously getting larger and larger, think of a child's balloon. And if you if you draw a pattern on a child's balloon, and then you put some more air into the balloon, how the pattern will simply get larger? Well, if you now think of the bubble that's coming out of your mouth, think of a pattern on the surface of that bubble, and it's a similar thing. As the bubble gets larger, so the pattern gets larger. And all sound emerging from your from your voice is in fact a pattern. And the patterns, providing you are speaking nicely, as you always do, Laura Lee, but if you're speaking with a normal sort of voice, you know, the patterns will be very beautiful to look at. If you were very angry and shouting at Paul, perhaps, the patterns would not be so harmonious. But if you think about a normal voice, the patterns are very, very beautiful, a bit like looking at a snowflake, in fact. So what I decided to do was to examine the sarcophagus in terms of its cymatic output. So what I first had to do was to repair the sarcophagus, because as we said earlier, one corner is quite badly broken away. So I repaired that corner temporarily, of course, with an aluminium right angle that I had taken along, especially for this purpose. I repaired it with that and also with some expanded polystyrene and sticky tape and all sorts of things, but basically repaired it and then stretched a membrane, a PVC membrane, over the top of the sarcophagus. I had a speaker, a little loudspeaker, placed in the bottom, and that was connected to an oscillator. And then I sprinkled sand onto the membrane from a little cappuccino chocolate shaker that I'd taken with me, sprinkle sand on the membrane, turn the oscillator on, and then start looking for a pattern to emerge on the surface of the membrane. Well, I can still remember the look on the antiquities inspector's face as he was watching me do this. He probably thought I was mad or something, I don't know, but anyway, looking rather bored. But what happened then got him rather excited, and me too, because very first frequency that I chose, a pattern emerged, and the pattern was of an ancient Egyptian hieroglyph.
Wow.
Yes, I'm speaking the truth here. A hieroglyph appeared on the surface of the membrane.
Boy, was it small? Did it take up the whole membrane? Was it very
clear?
Not
the whole membrane, no. This particular hieroglyph was what's called a SAR loop. It's the sign for protection. And I guess it was about a quarter of the width of the sarcophagus, but very, very clear. A beautiful hieroglyph appeared bang in the middle of the membrane. And
what is this hieroglyph? How is it shaped? What does it look like?
Well, you know the symbol for infinity, you know, this sort of figure of eight, infinity. It's a bit like that, but one end of the figure of eight is not closed, you know, it's open. So it's an eight, but with one side opened up.
Oh, right, gotcha.
That's the shape, that's
so
the general shape.
So the sand was jumping around and pushed by whatever forces to coalesce into this very shape. Wow.
Hmm. Yeah, that's right. And but then, of course, what happened then was I went on to alter the frequency of the oscillator, and every time I altered the frequency of the oscillator, a new pattern emerged. And most of the patterns that emerged, not all of them, but most of them were hieroglyphs, or what looked like hieroglyphs, let's say. And where the inspector had been, you know, standing rather bored initially.
That caught his attention.
Pardon?
That caught his attention.
Oh, he's got his attention, all right, absolutely. And he was then helping me to, you know, to scrape the sand back off the membrane, because every time you do this, you have to scrape the sand off, so you can sprinkle some more sand and then alter the oscillator and obviously create a new pattern, a new picture. And every time we did this, of course, we ended up with a new pattern. The patterns were quite amazing. I mean, not only hieroglyphs, but also some very, very interesting organic shapes emerged, where normally when you're doing cymatics, nearly all cymatic experiments, you get very, very geometric forms. You know, this is because of the harmonic structure of sound. They're very organized sort of patterns. They look, as I said earlier, like a snowflake with cellular divisions and everything looking as though it had been designed, as it were. But most of these patterns that emerged looked organic. Like, I mean, these shapes, if you think of the saw loop that I've just described there, you know, the figure of eight, there's nothing geometric about that. You know, the actual shapes themselves are almost ellipsoid. You know, they're sort of, they say, more organic than geometric. And this was the very first time I'd ever encountered this, because I've been studying cymatics for some years now and never seen anything like this. So clearly, these shapes, these patterns, the harmonic patterns, were coming from the granite itself in this sarcophagus. And every time, as I say, I changed the frequency, I got a new pattern or a new hieroglyph.
How many in total?
Pardon?
How many in total did you get? How many different patterns?
I got about 30 images from the sarcophagus. In fact, I recorded about 30 in black and white film, but there were many, many more that I just didn't have enough film to record. Hmm. I hadn't expected anything like this, you know. So clearly it would be very important for me to go back and repeat this experiment and take along a lot more film and see what else emerges from it, because I'm sure there's a lot more there yet to come. I've only scratched the surface of this data, which is, in a sense, it's encoded within the crystalline structure of the quartz within that sarcophagus.
So do you think it is the combination of the quartz and then the shape and the dimensions and the ratio of the sarcophagus? It's not like you could build a plywood box in the same shape and dimensions as the sarcophagus and put the membrane over it and get the same designs. It really is the material that
it is the quartz. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it is the quartz. Yeah. And it's interesting that you should mention that, Laura Lee, because plywood box, because that's exactly what I did back in my laboratory before I went out to Egypt in order to rehearse the experiments, because I only had a very short period of time allocated to me. I built a plywood sarcophagus of identical dimensions, stretched the membrane over, did the whole cymatic experiment, and got virtually nothing at all. I mean, one very simple set of striations, which you'll see in my booklet that you have there, that's all I got. Whereas, of course, what we're talking about here from the granite is an amazing set of images. So, yes, clearly it is the granite itself. It is the quartz content of the granite that is producing these amazing patterns. But it took me quite a long time to come to an understanding, to develop a hypothesis that would actually explain how these hieroglyphs came to be in the quartz. You know, I think a lot of people would probably, having heard this tale, would say, oh, well, maybe the ancient Egyptians encoded these secret hieroglyphs in the quartz crystal.
I would assume that they somehow did a similar experiment and saw these shapes and just said, this is a way to create a beautiful written language. These are living symbols. Let's use them. I would think
that's a more realistic hypothesis, isn't it, than saying
well,
that
the physics is already there. I mean, we can only read it and use it. It's not like
exactly.
We put the physics in there.
Yeah, my hypothesis, Laura Lee, is a little different to what you're suggesting there. It's quite possible, by the way, that they did do what you've said. They did this same sort of experiment. In fact, they used the skin of sacred bulls within some of their rituals. So it's not within the bounds of possibility that they could have performed a cymatic experiment. After all, they did use sacred skins from bulls. They did have plenty of sand. They had the human voice, and they could have lain in the sarcophagus and produced, you know, instead of my little loudspeaker, you put someone lying there and you perform various vocal tones and so on. And yes, they could have performed all of those experiments. I think it's a little unlikely, but it's certainly possible.
What is your hypothesis?
Sorry, Laura Lee.
What is your hypothesis?
Well, my hypothesis is basically, it took me a long time to come to this very simple conclusion, but this is my hypothesis, that going back to 3600 BC, that is the time when the ancient Egyptians were in the cradle, if you like, of their civilization. Their civilization was just emerging. And there's a place called Hierakonpolis, which is in Upper Egypt, And at this particular place, it's where two things happened in their history. The first is that they began to work with granite. Prior to this, they had only been working softer stones, and they'd been working wood. But now, at 3600 BC, they start to work granite. Now, at the same date in history, round about 3600 to 3900 BC, they also start to develop their hieroglyphic language.
Uh-huh.
Now, I do not believe that is a coincidence.
Uh-huh.
And what I'm suggesting is this, that the crystals within the granite material, the quartz crystals within the granite material, have a sort of encoded harmonic data within them. This is natural data which is put there by God, if you like, when the planet is formed, when granite is made millions and millions of years ago. This harmonic data is there. It's in all granite, basically. And when you strike granite with a tool, an iron tool or whatever,
it speaks and it shares its secrets.
It speaks, basically, yes. It gives off this amazing sound. Now, the sound, of course, is not just a sound. It is a pattern. Like I was saying earlier, sound has a pattern. Now, what happened was I actually went to a party of a friend of mine. This gentleman called David Elkington was having a 40th birthday party, and I went along to this 40th birthday party. And at this party, I met a woman called Amanda, and this woman has the amazing quality, I think it's called synesthesia, where you can hear, you can see sounds.
Right.
And I was very interested to know what these sounds were like that she could see, because
the cross-wiring of the senses, synesthesia.
It's cross-wiring of the senses, exactly.
Yeah.
She'd woken up apparently at 3 o'clock in the morning and could see all the sounds in her house, you know, sort of the creaking of the floorboards and the wind rattling the windows and things like this. She could see all the sounds. And this woman is an artist. Now, I had already, at the point when I went to this party, I'd already had this theory that maybe the scribes of ancient Egypt had been in the vicinity of this granite that was being worked, and maybe the acoustic energy coming off the granite, that they had sensed it. And
interesting.
Basically had,
if somebody
them,
was gifted with the synesthesia, they might have been able to see the sound waves,
the sound
in a
patterns,
sense.
Exactly.
The sound patterns, yeah.
And I think almost certainly that they saw the sound patterns at a sort of subliminal level. I don't really believe, although it's possible, but I don't really believe that the people or the scribes of ancient Egypt literally saw hieroglyphs in their head as a result of these sounds coming from the granite. But I do believe that the DNA within their bodies would have picked it up, basically, and they would have seen these shapes, these forms in their head at a subliminal level, possibly a subconscious level. And so when they were designing their hieroglyphic language, they were being subliminally influenced, let's say, to create these particular forms. And that is the basis of my hypothesis. This is how we have this similar dating between the first working of granite and the first use of the hieroglyphic language. And
oh,
I believe
that's fascinating. This should be part of the invention of language story eventually.
It is.
Yeah.
And I really would like to go back to Egypt as soon as I can to do more experiments, hopefully find yet more hieroglyphs lurking within the crystals of the sarcophagus, and of course it's going to be part of the book that I'm writing. This booklet that you've already got there, the Egyptian Sonics booklet, is the sort of core material.
John, what fascinating research! Thank you so much for sharing it with us and looking at the early sound therapy used by this very mysterious and ancient culture. And I'm sure there, again, we're just scratching the tip of the iceberg here. There's much more to tell. I'm glad acoustic engineers like you are out there tracking all this down and investigating this so thoroughly. That was acoustics engineer John Reed. Thank you for listening. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online, www.lauralee.com.